was a little bit shocked is that she had simply taken a quotation from one of these sheets and used it in the essay, clearly without understanding anything about where that quotation had come from and what the argument it was involved in, what the argument was that the quotation was involved in. So I give out these sheets to help you because they are, let's say, the more important ideas that come from the places and the people that I discuss. But please do not just take them and use them without understanding something about where it is that they come from and what the argument is that they are involved in, because this is going to be 100% certain to be a disaster. Okay, so just so I would say that I'll talk more about the essays next week, but I was a little bit disturbed about that. I mean, these sheets of quotations are meant to be kind of shortcuts for you and to indicate quotations that could be useful for you in writing an essay, but they shouldn't be used or abused, let's say, like that. Okay, the other thing I thought I would mention is that Andreasia has very kindly been recording the lectures and they are being put online, and I think most of them are in fact now available. And do you know the address?
It's Filovicki.
Okay, it's the Filovicki, yeah? So all of the lectures are there, I think almost all of them. So before you come to write your essays, if you think it's useful, you can go there and re-listen to the relevant lecture if you're doing an essay about Kant or whatever. So thank you, Andreas, for that. I think it's a very useful resource if you need to kind of quickly get your head around what is going on in Kant or Spinoza or whatever for your essay. All right. So, last week we saw Bourdieu's critique of Deleuze and the way that Bourdieu emphasized the classical distinction between the one and the many as a Platonic model for Deleuze's explanation for the universality of being, or his philosophy of immanence. Bourdieu argued that finally, Deleuze's philosophy could not coherently maintain its claim of univocity because in defending the priority of the one-all, Deleuze inevitably fell back into a Platonic distinction between a virtual ground, or being with a big B, and the actual being with a small b, that this ground produced. We also saw how this penetrating critique from Bourdieu could be defended against by emphasizing the reciprocal determination of virtual and actual in the process of individuation, by which univocal being was not only expressed, but also constructed. Okay, that's just a summary of what I did last week. Today, I'm going to try to lay out the bare bones of Bourdieu's complex and very different ontology, and if possible, if we have time, to explore some of its implications for aesthetics. Bourdieu's written quite extensively, he's written a bit about art. I don't think he's written as much as Deleuze, but he's certainly written some things. He's written a book about Beckett, I mentioned that last week. There's a small collection of essays called Handbook of Inesthetics, which are all writings about art in one way or another. In various places throughout his other work, there is discussions of art. But I think it's fair to say that art is not, or aesthetics are not as central to Bourdieu's ontology as they are to Deleuze's. But nevertheless, everybody these days seems to want to have a go at art, or talk about art in the philosophy world. It's very popular. These things kind of go up and down. But at least in the continental philosophy side, a lot of interest in art. Art and, of course, the current popular theme, politics. And they're often very much connected. I don't know if I have much of a chance to talk about this week about this, but next week perhaps there might be a chance for us to have some discussion about the contemporary state of affairs. Alright, Baudieu. Being, Baudieu argues, is pure multiplicity, untroubled by any distinction between whole and part. Being, Baudieu argues, is a multiple of multiples without, he says, any foundational stopping point. But if what is a multiplicity, then what we take to be a thing, a one bottle of Coke. If everything is a multiplicity, then what is one thing, a bottle of Coke, is, Baudieu says, not. It only exists, he says, as an operation, not as a thing. It doesn't have an ontological status, it has a, let's say, numerological status as one, but what makes it this one is nothing to do with what it is to do with an operation. And this operation, Baudieu calls the count as one. This operation is what presents the multiplicity of being in a situation, and what causes the multiple to, he says, split apart, to split into the inconsistent multiplicity or non-one of being, and into its presentation or count as one of what he calls a consistent multiplicity. So being is just multiples and multiples and multiples and multiples without any kind of ending and without any kind of foundation. It's just kind of difference in a way without difference, because there is only just difference and difference and difference and difference and difference, and every difference is the same as every other difference. There's this unending multiplicity and multiplicity and multiplicity. That is being, that is the ontological state. But nevertheless, obviously it's ridiculous to pretend otherwise, there are things. There are what we call a being. There is a bottle of Coke. There are what Baudieu calls ones, single things. So how does that work? How does that happen? Well, he says it's a kind of a split. You have being, which is this multiples of multiples without any kind of foundation. And you have this operation. It's a little bit Kantian in its kind of distinction now. You have this operation, which is a count as one. This is the way in which things somehow emerge. Things come into being or exist because they are counted as one. They are formed, or we should say not they are formed, but a consistent multiplicity is formed through this operation of the count. As a result, if what exists in the world are consistent multiplicities, then being as inconsistent multiplicity does not exist in the world and is, strictly speaking, nothing. It is, Baudieu says, void. That is, being, the ontological state of inconsistent multiplicity, is, in relationship to the operation count as one, which establishes things within a situation. This is now what we live. Within that situation, the inconsistent multiplicity cannot exist. It cannot be counted as one, therefore it is not a thing that exists. It is, Baudieu says, the void, a void. And we're going to come to this. This is the kind of tricky part of the whole operation. It can exist as void. It can exist as void, but it can only exist as void. We'll We'll see how that works. It's very important. All right. As Bourdieu puts it, this is the first quotation, it is only in completely thinking through the non-being of the One that the name of the void emerges as the unique conceivable presentation of what supports, as unpresentable and as pure multiplicity, any plural presentation that is any one effect. So, Bourdieu is saying that it is only by thinking through the void and how it operates that we can understand how anything appears as itself. Alright, we can already see then that Bourdieu holds basically Platonic position in which being is said in two different ways, namely as the non-being of inconsistent multiplicities and the count as one composing consistent multiplicities or things in a situation. So already Bourdieu admits it completely. He's not interested in producing a philosophy of univocity. He doesn't actually like philosophies of univocity. He is in the tradition of Plato, and from the beginning, being is said not in one way, but in two ways. Being always appears in two ways. One is how it is, let's say, in itself. Okay, it's dangerous to use these terms, but let's say as inconsistent multiplicity, yeah, which we cannot ever actually see or grasp or have contact with, in fact. Well, we do have a kind of contact with, I'll come to that. And consistent multiplicities, that's the second way in which being is said, and this is actual being, the things that we see, what is counted as one. When a multiplicity is counted as one, then it emerges within a situation as a thing, as a one, yeah? A thing. Okay, as we will see, Bourdieu will extend this Platonic dimension of his thought inasmuch as it is the void of inconsistent multiplicities that will give rise to ideas operating as determining truths within the world. So again, it has a strong Platonic element. The void, to give a very quick summation of what I'm going to go on to describe, the void emerges in an event by which the void appears within the world. This event produces a subject who names it. This name is a new eternal truth which the subject must force into the situation. When that is achieved, we have the emergence of a new universal truth, a new idea in Plato's sense. So the void gives rise to ideas. The ideas have a Platonic, let's say, aspect to them. Okay, I'm going to try and describe this a little bit more clearly. As void, then, being is always already subtracted from any count as one. A subtraction that is achieved in the very operation of presentation as such. So whenever there is something, we know that being as inconsistent multiplicity, being itself, has been subtracted from it. Yeah? It must be subtracted from it in order for something to appear, in order for there to be something that is counted as one. We can immediately see that this scheme owes much to the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, for whom the real was the realm of unmediated experience and oneness with the mother that ended with primary castration and entry into language. From that point on, all experience was mediated through the realm of the symbolic, that's for Lacan. So like Lacan, Bourdieu so this is similar to Lacan, then Bourdieu acknowledges the debt to Lacan. Lacan's part of the intellectual tradition that Bourdieu locates himself within. And this idea of the subtracted inconsistent multiplicity, or the subtracted being that is subtracted from anything that appears as count as one, is very similar to this distinction in Lacan between the real and the symbolic. Yeah? Things and experiences can only really appear within the symbolic and the imaginary a little bit for Lacan, but anyway, we'll stick with the symbolic. And what is real, yeah, which is precisely this unmediated experience we have of the world that we have prior to what Lacan calls primary castration, which is the moment, it's basically weaning, it's when we get a sense of ourselves separate from the mother. Yeah? The real is, let's say, repressed and becomes the unconscious at that point. Yeah? So this is a very similar structure to Bourdieu. Bourdieu is going to draw upon various other elements from Lacan also in his account. We can also immediately see, of course, that this is travelling a very different path from Deleuze and Guattari, who are going to reject exactly this element of Lacan, which is that primary castration is the key to desire, because for Lacan, desire is always the desire of something that we lack. What do we lack? We lack the phallus, and that is precisely the lack which is established by primary castration. So in Lacan, we are always desiring this symbol of the real, this phallus, but we can never get it. We can never have it. Yeah? It's impossible because our very subjectivity is determined by the experience of this separation. Yeah? So it's the same in Bourdieu, right? It's like as much as we try and find this inconsistent multiplicity, this being that has been subtracted from the world of things, we can never find it because this world of things is actually premised upon the subtraction of being. Yeah? So for Deleuze and Guattari, of course, in relationship to Lacan, though there are many things they're very interested in with Lacan, and of course we know Guattari did a training analysis with Lacan, they reject this element of lack as determining desire. Desire is never lack, they say. Desire is always a positive, affirmative energy. Yeah? It's never determined by what we're missing. Yeah? It's always a presence and a fullness. So there's a very strict distinction they make from themselves and Lacan. Okay, like Lacan, Bourdieu also draws significantly from mathematics to demonstrate this point. It's another difference with Deleuze. Bourdieu claims that it was the mathematician Georg Cantor that both recognized the paradox existing between inconsistent and consistent multiplicities and offered a way out of it, he says, by creating the mathematical theory of the pure multiple, which is known as set theory. Cantor's set theory allows us to count as one, not things, but let's say, to understand the properties by which they are counted as one. So this set theory allows us to count as one everything that exhibits a certain property. But what is counted here is not a thing, a one, but a set, a multiple, making set theory the condition of Bourdieu's rather startling claim that the thinking of a pure multiplicity is finally mathematics. In this sense, set theory is the means to formalize presentation and its operation of count as one, or its various operations, in fact, achieve this. But in doing so, it also performs a crucial ontological operation. This is the second quotation on the sheet. Bourdieu says, set theory fixes the point of non-being from whence it can be established that there is a presentation of being. This means ontology as mathematics. So mathematics, set theory, is the identification of the axioms Bedu is going to say, axiom has a very specific sense in mathematics and in philosophy. It means something which cannot itself be proven, but which you assume to be true in order to, let's say, prove a whole series of arguments that rest upon it. So if any of you tried to have a look at Spinoza, or have had a look at Spinoza, you know that it all begins from five basic axioms. He says, these are the basic axioms, we can't prove this, but everything is going to rest on that. So it means if we accept that this is true, then, duk, 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 and on it goes in a very complicated manner for a long time. So this is a form of argumentation that is used in mathematics and used to be used a lot more in philosophy than it is today, but Bourdieu offers a certain kind of return to this idea because he is going to, in his, let's say, magnum opus, Being an Event, he's going to establish the basic axioms of, or he's going to use, I should say, the basic axioms of set theory. It means the rules of inclusion and belonging, the rules of inclusion and belonging, the axioms which determine these rules, or which are, constitute these rules. He's going to show what, let's say, the implications are for ontology. Yeah? So in other words, moving from these basic mathematical axioms or axioms of set theory, these in fact were developed after Cantor by Zumello and Frankl, he's going to show what the ontological, let's say, implications of these rules for belonging and inclusion and sets, what the implications are. These axioms provide or determine the possible relations of belonging and inclusion that define a set as a consistent multiplicity, and hence define the conditions of the presentation of being. So they define the conditions under which it is possible to count something as one. Set theory therefore attributes to sets no other essence than being a multiplicity, and establishes that every set of a set is also a set. So in other words, it conforms to the basic ontological principle of multiplicity, but it provides axioms by which it can be understood how these sets or multiplicities are formed, and what the implications of these axioms are. In other words, to understand their consistency with each other and what they imply. This is what Bourdieu is going to develop in his book. This, Bourdieu argues, is a realization of the idea that every multiple is a multiple of multiples, that every set of a set is a set. Without reference to any unities. There are no unities that unify all of the sets. Yeah? There is no set of all the sets. Just like there is no multiple of all the multiples. There is no whole, there is no one in the sense of Deleuze. Yeah? It's just an infinity of multiplicity. It is important to note, So this realization that every multiple is a multiple of multiples without reference to any unity means that being or ontology in this sense is not philosophical but mathematical. That's one of the more, let's say, provocative statements that Bourdieu wants to make. Ontology is not philosophy, ontology is mathematics. It is important to note that, as with Deleuze, being does not precede its presentation. So there is not a kind of a being out there which is waiting to be counted as one. The being doesn't pre-exist the counting as one. It's just like in Deleuze, the virtual doesn't pre-exist its actualization. The virtual comes into being along with its actualization as part of the process of individuation or actualization. This is the necessity of immanence. Yeah? You can't have pre-existing being. So being emerges in a situation as the result of the count as one operations, is what is always already foreclosed. That's another Lacanian term, foreclosed in these operations. It means that this presentation of the one, this counting of one, involves in its process the necessity of the void, yeah, of this foreclosure. And it is the necessity of this foreclosure which creates its inconsistent multiplicity. So the subtraction, yeah, of the void, which is a necessary part of the process of counting as one, yeah, it must always be assumed as being part of the process of counting as one. It is that part which cannot be counted in the process of counting as one. It is the void in the count. Yeah, has to always be assumed as a necessary part of the count. It is this latter, this counting as one, Baijiu argues, which causes the structured presentation to waver towards the phantom of inconsistency. There's a problem. That there is the count, which produces being, which produces things in the world, but it always contains this kind of void. It's necessary, yeah, as what is subtracted from the count. So there is always this kind of waver in being, this kind of inconsistency which it's premised upon. Yeah? This subtraction, which is the condition of something appearing or being. So there is this kind of infection. it's exactly what happens in Lacan, yeah? The real is the unconscious, but it's always kind of there, you know, it's kind of eating away. It's kind of eating away, and it's going to emerge sometimes. Nothing you can do about it, right? Like, everyone has to sleep. So it's going to come and get you. And this is kind of going to be the dynamic that Baijiu is going to explore. This means, within the situation, relations of belonging and inclusion that are given in the axioms of set theory define when and how a multiplicity can be counted as one, as a consistent multiple, while what evades the count, the void of the not one, or inconsistent multiple, is subtracted from it. Subtraction makes the void a conditional subset of any set. Baijiu calls it a universal inclusion, but it includes the void only as lack. Again, the Lacanian echo, as what avoids any count of positive terms and so cannot belong to a set. To be counted as one is therefore the law of presentation, but like all laws, this one can be broken. Now, this is going to be very important for Baijiu, because Baijiu is a very political philosopher, and this whole ontological account is going to be given a very political sense, because Baijiu is going to argue that this law of presentation, that there is the subtraction of the void for the count of one, that this law is exactly the state law. Yeah? And that the void is going to be a kind of eruption of militancy. But militancy has this kind of ontological fabric. Yeah? That militancy is an ontological operation, because militancy is when the void, what cannot be counted by the state, or cannot, he's going to say, be represented by the state, emerges. And this void is going to be the breaking of the law. It's going to be illegal. Yeah? So it's going to be philosophers against the cops. It's great. Fantastic. It's better than any film. All right, let's see how it works. To be counted as one, okay, is therefore the law of presentation, but like all laws, this one can be broken. Indeed, there is always the danger the danger for the law of an inconsistent multiplicity haunting the situation as such as the presentation of subtraction itself. So this is the danger from the point of view of the state or of the situation, that there will be something within the situation that is able to present the subtraction, that is able to present what cannot be presented within the situation, that the void is going to emerge within the situation. This is the possibility inherent in the fact that subtraction is the suture, as Bourdieu calls it, using another term from Lacanian psychoanalysis, the suture, kind of means the sewing together of being qua inconsistent multiple, and its presentation qua consistent multiple, an ambiguous double movement of rejection and embrace. So it means that this presentation of a consistent multiple, this presentation of a state of affairs, of a situation, this count as one which produces things in the world, it always involves, yeah, this subtraction of the inconsistent multiple from it. It always involves the subtraction of the void in order for it to count as one. Yeah? So there is always this kind of necessity of the fact that non-being and being are always going to be implicated together. You cannot have one without the other. This is what Bourdieu argues is the great insight of set theory, of Cantor. This is the great mathematical contribution. The danger for presentation for the state, and hence the danger for the consistency of things, is that it is in the uncounted nature of the count itself that the void adheres. In other words, it's exactly the fact that the count as one produces things. But what about the count itself? The count itself is not counted. And the danger is that the void appears or exists exactly within this uncounted nature of the count itself. So to protect the structure of the count against this possibility, there must be a count of the count, as Bourdieu calls it, a metastructure within which all the axioms of presentation given to us by set theory can be counted as one in order to secure the structure against the void. Bourdieu argues that this metastructure establishes a state of the situation and inaugurates, this is a quotation, the reign, since completeness is numbered, of the universal security of the one. The book is written in 1988, the original French book, but obviously we can already hear these kinds of wonderful echoes of our contemporary situation. Yeah? It's all about security, ensuring security against this kind of subversive, militant force of the void. Later, in his later work, he's going to specifically address the figure of the terrorist and so forth and so on within contemporary society. It's very, one of the great, strengths of Bourdieu's philosophy is that it's entirely oriented towards the contemporary. And that's, as we'll see, or as I hope to show, not just the philosophical structure that he's elaborating, which is entirely connected to the contemporary, but also the flavour of the thought itself is very much influenced by our contemporary situation. So, this count of the count, it has to ensure the security of the one. To be counted as one means a multiple is presented as belonging within a situation, but when this count is itself counted, and so included within the situation, which is what has to be done, the count has to be brought into the situation so as not to be the way in which, let's say, the situation is infected by the void. Yeah? So to be brought into the situation, the count has to be counted, This means, Bedu says, the multiple is represented. Representation is therefore the fiction by which the one attains being, by which what is included in the situation are only the one multiples that belong to it, meaning the void is banished. It's also Bedu's term. The void is banished. To both belong, which means to be presented as one, and to be included, it means to be represented within the situation, is to be, Bedu says, normal. That is to be a normal, a normality. On the other hand, this is going to become important, to be represented in the situation, but not to be present or presented, is to be what Bedu calls an excrescence. It means something in excess of the situation. And to be present in a situation, but not to be represented, this is going to be one of the most important aspects of militancy, marks what Bedu calls a singularity. It's present in the situation, but it's not represented in the situation. These last two excessive terms, the excrescence and the singularity, name the suture, the connection, the void and its presentation, and appear, as we shall see, as what cannot be counted as one by the state of the situation. So, in other words, these are going to be the moments where something which cannot be counted as one is going to appear within the situation. Okay, this is the unlawful moment. This is what is in excess of the rules of the situation, the rules of presentation and representation. They're going to be the rules of the state, according to Bedu. These moments, excrescence and singularity, are going to be the moments where something which cannot be counted by the situation, cannot in fact be controlled by the situation, cannot be named by the situation, are going to appear. For Bedu, now we start to see the centrality of politics to Bedu's ontology. For Bedu, the state of the situation is controlled by the political state, and more precisely by the representational functions of the state. And this is one reason why Bedu will never stop attacking state democracy. He's a Maoist. It's obvious he's going to attack state democracy. Bedu is much more for the dictatorship of the proletariat. Excrescence and singularity will be the names of both ontological emergence and aesthetic creation, which, because they are both fundamentally concerned with the arrival of the new, are essentially the same thing. This is a similarity to Deleuze, that the ontology and aesthetics both revolve around the creation of the new, but the mechanism by which the new is created in Bedu and Deleuze are completely different. As well, the excrescence and singularity are going to be the conditions of any genuine political resistance. Obviously, because Bedu rejects any kind of representational democracy, political resistance is going to take on a violent form. So political resistance is not going to be democratic or representational. Political resistance is going to be the emergence of something completely outside and against state organisation. Yeah. Again, he's a Maoist. And so he's not going to back away from this either. So he's going to say, in one place, in specific reference to the amount of killing that was performed by the Chinese Revolution, that basically it was worth it. So it's very radical the way he presents himself, and it's unapologetic. Yeah? It It's like, this is what is required. The appearance of a singularity, it means something that is present in the situation, but is not represented in the situation, okay? So a singularity is something which is there in the situation, but it cannot be counted as one. It's present, but it is not represented. The appearance of a singularity is fleeting and real, and is what Bourdieu calls an event. Very important concept in Bourdieu, this crucial book, is called Being and Event. The event is the crucial concept. So the appearance of a singularity is going to be what he calls an event. Within the world of structured presentation and representation, an event, which is by definition a kind of cataclysm, a kind of catastrophe, presents an inconsistent multiplicity, what Bourdieu calls an ultra one, that is a more than one, that includes the void of the situation, what had in psychoanalytical and political terms been repressed. Yeah? So both a political and a psychoanalytical term. So the event is the eruption of this void that is precisely what had been subtracted from the situation in order for the situation to emerge in the first place. In other words, what it was that the situational state had repressed in order to be what it in fact was, suddenly appears within the situation as, Bourdieu says, retroactively discernible. So, in other words, when event emerges, what it eventually is going to allow us to see is what could not appear within that situation. What it was, the impossibility that was the condition of that situation appearing. Yeah? So when an event emerges, it makes this impossibility or this void retroactively discernible. It means that we can see what was impossible in order for the situation to present itself. The emergence of an event signals what was impossible or void within the state situation. This militant event is the genetic moment of Bourdieu's ontology, erupting within his four categories, which are science, politics, art, and love. We note that philosophy is not one of the fundamental categories. Philosophy, he's going to go on to say, is like a kind of... He calls philosophy the procuress of these four categories, but we could maybe say in more contemporary language, philosophy is the pimp of these four categories. But what is most interesting about it is, okay, science, politics, and art, we can kind of understand, but love. Love is the personal, subjective dimension. And in many ways, it's in the dimension of love that maybe it's easiest to understand Bourdieu's concept of the event. So, in love, the event is like an encounter that occurs with somebody in which what was impossible suddenly emerges in its kind of cruel and exciting reality. Yeah? And it creates subjects too, yeah, who then continue, if love truly exists, according to Bourdieu, who they then continue in fidelity to this event, which has completely changed who and what they are. And that is the definition of love for Bourdieu. So that is, let's say, the ontological definition of love. Yeah, I'm sure that's like every philosopher wants to find that. The ontological definition of love for Bourdieu. So these four categories, science, politics, art, and love, are the four faculties of the noumenal void that create themselves in creating new truths, new retroactive namings of what was not. I'm going to come to explain this in a bit more detail. The event, therefore illuminates and incinerates in its explosion the axioms acting as the contemporary conditions of appearance, the current, Baudieu calls it, logical grammar of belonging. Yeah? So this event emerges, it illuminates, it shows what the current conditions of belonging to the state are, the current conditions of representation. And it also changes them, destroys them, maybe it's too strong. It adds a new axiom. It creates a new truth. Yeah? I'll talk about this more. This is the ontogenetic, the creative aspect of the event that is going to create a new truth, a new axiom of belonging to the situation, a new way of being, we might say. These conditions are natural inasmuch as everything they include can be counted as one. All of the existing axioms, these are natural. These are what constitute nature for Baudieu. So again, it's a different idea from Deleuze. In Deleuze, nature is precisely, let's say, the vital being and becoming of the one all, of the cosmos, of the earth, as they sometimes call it. Yeah, this is nature. Nature is, for Deleuze and Guattari, what really lies outside of the laws and the kind of re-territorializations and striations and strata of the state. But for Baudieu, it's the opposite. For Baudieu, nature is simply that set of laws which constitutes what exists at any given time. And that is natural, the set of axioms which determine what can be counted as one at any given time. So it's always historically contextualized. So nature is always, let's say, a historical existence, because it's only it's only the laws or the axioms by which something can be counted as one at any given time, because it changes. It changes what can be counted as one over time as new events emerge and determine new axioms and new truths. The state polices, or the same thing, produces nature by numbering and ordering all situations into subsets representable in language. It's why it forms a logical grammar. The axioms form a logical grammar. It's, again, echoes Wittgenstein in his account. There is no room here for a singularity that cannot be represented, that is included, within an existing social subset. The state, Baudieu provocatively argues, is not founded on a social bond, which is more or less the usual understanding of the state, but upon the prohibition and prevention of unbinding, as he calls it, maintained through its administrative and management functions. So the function of the state, therefore, is not based upon, let's say, any kind of inherent human need for society, or upon a kind of fundamental drive towards social organization or anything like that. The state is simply a kind of administrative and management function which prevents any kind of emergence of something which doesn't fit into its laws. Yeah? That's the function. So basically, for Baudieu, the state is fundamentally a police state. The function of the state is to police normality and to maintain it, to refuse any singularity a name. Yeah? The state, in other words, is fundamentally repressive, and in good Maoist fashion, can only be confronted by a politics which in Baudieu is also an ontology of permanent revolution. So the state is like a permanent problem, and can, because obviously it is this police mechanism which is ontological, yeah? It's exactly the naming of what is. So you can't destroy it, it's always going to be there. It can only be fought against continually. Continual revolution is the only answer, permanent revolution. As one of Mao's most famous slogans had it. This was very big in the 60s. Bomb the headquarters. Okay, so that's like on, that's kind of bad news ontology, right? Bomb the headquarters. It's like whatever happens to be the law of the time, yeah, bomb it. The state's representative functions do not deal with individuals, but with submultiples or classes. This is Badger's argument. And because it maintains the natural or existing order, Badger argues that the state is the state of the ruling class. And then we start to get more Marxist ideas coming into the account. This means that today, the state reproduces the situation on an ontological level as it has been structured by capitalism, by the normal rules of regulation, and therefore protects the state, protects the interests of the capitalist class. And in fact, we know this is true in as much as every political party today is business friendly. Yeah, so the state, it doesn't matter if it's left, right, whatever. Yeah, it's all business friendly. In other words, it's all ways about defending the position of the ruling class, the capitalist class. Under these conditions, this is the next quotation, under these conditions, politics, this is Badiou, politics can be defined as an assault against the state, whatever the mode of that assault might be, peaceful or violent. This assault on the state in the name of the event, the eruption of the void, will be a necessary criterion not just for politics, but also for science, the arts, and lovers everywhere. Because this assault is the only option for any creative practice, given that it is impossible for the state to produce an event, making not only the politically committed, but artists, scientists, and lovers too, all activists. Or, as Badiou calls them, this is the next quotation, patient watchmen of the void, who are to illuminate, if only for an instant, the sight of the unpresentable and the means to be thenceforth faithful to the proper name that afterwards he or she will have been able to give to, or here one cannot decide, this place, this non-place of place, the void. So this is the function of all militants, all activists, that is, in effect, all people interested in truth, whether they be scientists, artists, political activists or lovers, they are constantly looking out for, in order to articulate, this name that does not yet exist, which would be the name that could be given to the void of the situation, to what escapes the state. This makes creation, the invention of a new truth, a fundamentally criminal act that will determine the life of the militant, the subject who remains faithful to this life-changing event. As Badiou puts it, the naming of the event is essentially illegal in that it cannot conform to any law of representation. So this question of faithfulness, he calls it fidelity, it's very important. There is an event. There is a subject who is formed by this event. That is, the subject who hears this unnameable void, who is able then to articulate this unnameable void, to give it a name. But this is a long process, and is called by Badiou forcing the truth. It means that the subject who is formed by the event must remain faithful to it in order to force its truth upon society, upon the state, in order to force a new truth into existence. This requires, of course, it's classic militancy rhetoric, fidelity, faithfulness. And Badiou is going to write a whole book about St. Paul and the conversion on the road to Damascus, this event which completely changes Paul's life, and that he spends the rest of his life in fidelity to this event, spreading Christianity and the Word of God. So it seems an unlikely combination, St. Paul and Maoism, but nevertheless this is something of the contradictory nature, and I think quite fascinating nature of Baijiu's philosophy. We might say that this fidelity is also in spirit quite opposite to Deleuze. Deleuze, of course, is basically about becoming. It's the fundamental aspect of Deleuze's philosophy is about the creation of new is to become something else, to become something admittedly which we could understand as not being nameable within the current situation, to become other. But it's a process of change, it's a process of mutation. Whereas for Baijiu, the question is first of all a fidelity, but a fidelity to some event, which is a kind of explosion, a kind of instantaneous eruption of a new truth. It's not a becoming. It's an event. It's boom, there it is. So these are very different kinds of, I guess we could say, tastes in philosophy. The name, the appearance of politics as such, is a singular, inconsistent multiple. This name of the event, I mean, is a singular, inconsistent multiple whose elements don't belong to the situation, appearing instead in an evental site, this is what Baijiu calls it, an evental site on the edge of the void. An evental site, an eruption, an event that exists just on the edge of the void. The site belongs to the situation, but what belongs to the site, the event itself, does not belong to the situation. So this is the singularity.
Can I ask a question? Probably you already said it, but what triggers the event?
Well, nothing outside of the situation can trigger the event, because there is nothing outside of the situation. The situation has created its own void in its own process of naming, because every count as one involves the subtraction of the void. In order to name the one, in order to count as one, you have to subtract from it the void. So every moment the state produces itself, it is also producing the void. It's a necessary part of its process. Normally that's no problem, because everyone just continues on and the void is just repressed and it's not an issue. But occasionally something will emerge, or this void will not be contained, that it will be possible to name something which is within the situation. This is this site. It exists within the situation, but what exists within it doesn't exist within the situation. That's the void. So the void never exists in the situation, but there is something, it has an effect in the situation. It hollows out an area within the situation that belongs to the situation, but what's within that area doesn't belong to the situation. And this is the emergence of what has been repressed, or what has been impossible to name up until that point by the situation. And according to Baijiu, this is the emergence of a new truth. This is the emergence of a new axiom of belonging to the situation. The situation becomes fundamentally changed. The laws change. At that moment, something new can exist that previously hadn't existed. Like what, we say, like what? Okay, French Revolution. French Revolution is like an event. What emerges is a kind of new concept of democracy, which is going to be incredibly important. All the rules are changed after that point. That's an event. What else? Greek tragedy. A whole new form It's incredibly important. It didn't exist beforehand. All of a sudden, boom, there it is. Yeah? What else? 12-tone music. Yeah? Everything changes. All the rules determining the construction of music change. Schoenberg. Yeah? This is an event. So these are very fundamental things, very important things. Yeah? It's a very, I'm going to get onto this, it's an aristocratic and elitist conception of historical process, because it's only these things which are truly worthy of thought. So if you're an artist, you've got to try and like do something like that, something that completely reinvents the entire conditions and possibilities of your art.
How can you try it if it comes on its own? Yeah?
Well, yes, it comes on its own. Maybe, if you're lucky. Well, you see, you don't just have to be lucky. That's the point, because it's not spontaneism. Mm-hmm. He has that against Deleuze in terms of politics. I want to talk a bit about that. It's not spontaneous. It's not just suddenly like boom. Oh, I'm a genius, right? It's like all artists are having these kinds of ideas, or philosophers or whatever, political activists. Maybe political activism is a good example. Political activists are working towards changing the structure of society. Yeah? They might have a vision of a new kind of structure, a different structure, or even just a single thing that needs to be added or whatever. It's not their idea which is going to make that happen. What's going to make it happen, according to Bourdieu, is their fidelity to that idea or that event. Yeah? So in other words, it's not just someone saying, oh, I thought up of a whole new way to make music. That's not going to change anything. What's going to change everything is going to be that person writing over a period of a lifetime a large body of work that's going to completely change the definition of music. Okay, so that's not a spontaneous boof.
So you have to mutate.
You know, you have to work. Yeah. You have to work, and you have to maintain fidelity. You have to remain faithful to this event.
May I try to explain it? I think it's to find a new point of view, like Darwin did.
Yes.
In finding out something about a situation or whatever, everybody thinks he knows what it is like, and then someone sees it differently. Maybe it's like that.
It is like that, but be careful not to make it too banal. Because for Bourdieu, it's these incredible things. It's not something that happens to everybody every day, except in your, maybe if you have the... If you have had this experience of love in the way that Bourdieu describes it, that's where it can impact you on a subjective level. But on these other levels, politics, science, and art, it's very, very big things. Yeah, it's like epoch changing.
What is the relation between the event in Bourdieu to the encounter that kind of gets you thinking in Deleuze? Because he says this thinking is very rare; it just sometimes hits you, and then you have the idea of
it is a possible point of intersection. I mean, for Deleuze, this encounter is precisely with the unthought. That we have this encounter with the unthought, and this is what makes us think. Yeah? That we, when we think, we are trying to think what has not been thought, and that is to create a new thought. Yeah? But in Deleuze and in Bourdieu, these two things are operating according to a different ontology. So there have been attempts to think them together and to suggest that Deleuze also uses a kind of subtractive mechanism. That means that when, you know, what is the unthought? The unthought is everything subtracted from thought, yeah? But I think it's not so easy to maintain this on the ontological level, because for Deleuze, everything is determined by this universality of being. So whatever is outside is anyway internal to the universality of being, because you cannot say it in a way that is other than what is. So what is not has to be said in the same way as what is if univocal being is to maintain its consistency. Now, for Baijiu, there is no requirement in that direction. In Baijiu, it's quite possible, in fact, everything rests upon non-being or the void being of a completely different ontological nature to what is. So, although there are echoes, there's a book that's called Out of This World by a man named Peter Hallward, which is a reading of Deleuze, which tries to bring him much, much closer towards Baijiu. I mean, obviously, it's in the shadow of Baijiu's book anyway. And the book by Zizek about Deleuze is another one, which very closely follows the Baijiuian line. So there is quite some work around, let's say, bringing them together. That work is generally weighted in the way that Baijiu's book is, which is to make Deleuze a kind of unsuccessful echo of Baijiu's own ontology. But I think that this is not, at least to me, so convincing, because the differences are much stronger. So you can hear an echo there if you want to, but you'd have to think it through very carefully in relationship with the two ontologies to see if that was really truly a kind of similarity, or to what level, let's say, the similarity might go. Yeah. All right. So, the sight belongs to the sight, the event sight belongs to the situation, but what belongs to the event sight doesn't belong to the situation. It's a singularity. The event can only be counted, this is a quotation now on the page, the event can only be counted as the arrival in being of non-being, the arrival amidst the visible of the invisible. This is a glorious arrival, a naming of the event that forces the situation to, this is Baijiu again, forces the situation to confess its own void and to thereby let forth from inconsistent being and the interrupted count, the incandescent, means this kind of glowing non-being of an existence. This existence is first of all a generic truth, this is what Baijiu calls it, a part of the situation that marks its fundamental inconsistency. A truth, this is the next quotation on the page, a truth is this minimal consistency, a part, a conceptless immanence, which certifies in the situation the inconsistency from which its being is made. So it's this minimal consistency which doesn't as yet signify anything. It only signifies this inconsistency of which it's made up, the void itself. This truth is generic because once it appears, it exists in every situation. It is universal, eternal, and belongs to everyone. Again, this is another very strong Platonic element of Baijiu's idea. So this truth is an idea that is universally true. Yeah? Didn't, but it's only just come into existence. Yeah? But it exists as being true for everyone. And this also, for Baijiu, has a very political meaning, because he says the generic is egalitarian. Politics, for Baijiu, is in this sense, he says, a communism of singularities, inasmuch as truth is indifferent to differences and the same for all. Indeed, difference, multiculturalism and postmodernism are Baijiu's examples, is, he says, precisely what truths depose or render insignificant. The power of political truth, he says, is not in representing differences, which, he says, holds no interest for thought, but in recognizing what is the same, what is eternally true for all in its assault on the state. This is a kind of weird, inverted Plato, where the philosopher's job is to hurl eternal truths against the state. For it is this event the state attempts to repress. The state, Baijiu says, attempts the void avoided, tries to avoid the void. It's the way that Baijiu puts it. because the event implies a new egalitarianism, a new justice founded in truth. So the state tries to avoid the void, it tries to avoid these new truths, because these new truths represent a kind of communism, a kind of egalitarianism, because they are true for everybody, no matter what. They don't represent any class interests. So the task for philosophy, this is very interesting, this is very much against the grain of recent thinking, particularly American thinking, yeah, is that, you know, philosophy and politics has nothing to do with defending difference. It's nothing to do with, you know, ensuring the rights of the minorities. Yeah? That has no interest for philosophy, Beju says. It's just a complete waste of time. Yeah? He says, I think I mentioned this last week, he says, the difference between an Iraqi terrorist and my uncle in Lyon is the same as the difference between me and myself. Yeah. In other words, difference, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. That's not the point at all. The point is to find something which is universally true for everybody and which had not previously been thought. Yeah. That's the real political action, because that puts something against the state, that disrupts the state, that attacks the state, on the level of an egalitarian idea, of an idea that applies, that is true for all, yeah? And that has no interest in a specific group.
Yeah? Isn't militancy against all that?
Yeah, of course, exactly. That's the kind of provocation of Bourdieu, yeah? Is that militancy is about universal truth. But universal truth has not existed forever. Universal truth must be fought for. It must be invented. It must be created. Yeah? Our fidelity to the event must bring a new truth into being. That is what politics and militancy is for Bourdieu. And it's, you're right, that's exactly against what the traditional idea of political militancy is, at least on the left, which is about the defense of the rights of difference. Yeah? So he just wants to completely get rid of all of that. That's not what it is for him. The event is first of all an intervention that consists in identifying that there has been some undecidability and deciding it belongs in the situation. This decision takes the form of a nomination, a name. But how can such a naming be possible when it is precisely as void that the event appears? As Bourdieu puts it, this is the next quotation, the striking paradox of our undertaking is that we are going to try to name the very thing which is impossible to discern. We are searching for a language for the unnameable. It's kind of paradoxical and undertaking, a language of the unnameable. Bourdieu argues that this requires a subject prepared to contest the law and to agitate on behalf of an illegal name that is not allowed within representation. So, also in further answer to your question, for example, in relationship to this, Bourdieu has tirelessly fought for the rights of the sans-papier in France, so those without papers, because he sees that as being precisely a political problem that fits very exactly with this. These are people who basically have no name within the rules of the state. They are a kind of a void within the situation, and they must be given a name, and must be given that they are a kind of an event which must be presented within the situation. Yeah? And so that is this, in a practical sense, the kind of militancy that he advocates. Yeah? So it is real, and in this sense, it is in line with fairly traditional leftist interests. So he supports those illegal immigrants into France who have no legal papers, and he says there must be some kind of legal mechanism put into place which recognizes these people legally, administratively, and so forth and so on within France. So this is an example of the way that a void, an unnameable, what is unnameable within the situation, these people with no papers, that they can, to name them is to completely change the relationship of the state to those that it regards as being illegal.
So being always being militant on ontological levels, but in this case for those people, but if they stand up and fight back, it's always this.
But the question
taste of fear and
the question is not in itself fighting. The question is how and what you fight. I mean, you know, obviously, if these people attack policemen or whatever, that's not going to change the attitude or the situation as far as the state's concerned, just the opposite. So it's not that Badiou doesn't advocate fighting the police, it's just about how you're going to do it. There's no point in doing it unless it's going to actually do something. Yeah? So unless it's part of a process which is going to force the state to change its legal apparatus, then obviously there's no point to it.
But this can also result in assimilation. If you give people papers, we don't have papers, it can be an assimilation.
Well, then it's not going to be the naming of an event.
Okay.
If in that case, it's no longer going to be, it's not going to be the emergence of a new truth, it's just going to be the assimilation of something that was outside into a pre-existing inside. And that, of course, is a real danger that you have to think about when you're doing this. Because unless you can really force a new generic truth to emerge, then you haven't achieved anything. You've just achieved maybe something bad, a kind of an assimilation,
exactly.
But Badiou is very aware of that. I mean, that's a real danger. It's definitely a real danger. Yes. The name of the event, this new truth, names what will not have been, what will not have been allowed within the situation before it was named. This makes philosophy and the subject who upholds the truth of the event utterly contemporary. Because it is always a matter of deciphering within the present what the present does not allow. This is what I was talking about before. It makes ontology into a very contemporary thing. Yeah? It's about analysing what the contemporary event cannot say. What is the void of the contemporary situation? Yeah? So the horizon for creation, whether that creation is understood ontologically, artistically, politically, is always the present. And that, I think, is a very powerful idea. In this sense, the event has no relation to time, and unlike Deleuze, philosophy has no relation to temporality. But it is precisely because of this that the event is always utterly contemporary, because it is what is missing from this situation, the truth that contemporary state forces cannot allow. Rather than counting as one within the situation, the nominal intervention names the event according to a different logic, that of the two, by which the event is both absent and present in a supernumerary name, a name that is both an anomaly within the state and an enigma. This was what I was indicating before, that there is the event site is within the situation. But what is within the event site, the event itself, is not in the situation. So it has a kind of different logic. It's no longer appearing under this logic of the count as one, but it has a kind of a two element, yeah? That is both what is inside the event, what is inside the situation, but which is also outside the situation. This is what he means by supernumerary. It exists outside of the numerical count, or both inside and outside. The numerical count. The militant announces this enigmatic name of the event through a set of procedures Badiou calls fidelity. Fidelity is a militant naming by which the event appears within the situation, thus creating a revolutionary, and this is Badiou's word, counter-state. This is the next quotation now. A fidelity is definitively distinct from the state if, in some manner, it is unassignable to a defined function of the state, its result, a particularly nonsensical part. This is an answer to your question, yeah? This is precisely the point about the assimilation. So it's only distinct from the state if it's unassignable to a defined function of the state. So we can only say that it is truly a name of an event in relationship to those of our papers in France if a name can be given that does not already exist within the apparatus of the state. So that a new kind of legal function can be invented in order to incorporate these people within the situation. Yeah? Only then has a new truth emerged. If you find a way of kind of incorporating them in through what is already existing, then you've simply assimilated and the fundamental nature of the state has not changed.
Just the content, but not the structure.
Just the content has just changed, but the structure remains the same. Yeah.
But doesn't mean that the universal for everyone is possible? Or is he saying that the fact that it's not possible makes it possible? You know what I mean? That there's the only constant thing is that it always has to be kind of a revolutionary.
That's right, a continuous revolution is the process of continually inventing new truths.
So he says that in fact that you have to be faithful because it's...
That's how it comes into being.
Yes, that in fact it's illusionary to think that what you're doing right now is the only truth you do, so you have to be faithful to it, but it's the only way of...
You cannot prove it. It's the classic... It's a very old idea that is you often put around artistic avant-garde movements and so forth and so on, yeah, that we're not really going to know what the major innovations were for another 50 years, because at that point it's going to be kind of sorted out whose work was really important and whose work was not. It's a little bit like that. It's like it's like a bet, it's like a gamble. We put a bet on a certain event and we remain faithful to that and work for our entire lives according to that event. And maybe we will never actually know if we succeeded in forcing it into the situation. But in 50 years, then maybe you will be able to see, did it really work or not? But then there are other cases, say for example with the French Revolution, where I think it was probably very obvious to the people involved that they were precisely forcing a very new thing into the world. So it can be either way, I think. And on a personal level, I think anyway, whether it ends up having a kind of universal effect or not, the effect on your own life is dramatic. And I think that's also important. He's talking about a way of living. In faithfulness to something which has changed everything.
So it's also a kind of perspective, because for the people without papers, it can be the all-changing dramatic event, but for the government it could be just a simple form of assimilation.
No, it's not.
It has to be on both sides.
It has to be. I mean, if it's just a form of assimilation, then it's just a form of assimilation.
From different points of view.
No, there's no different points of view. It's universal.
Yeah.
So either the people without papers did produce a new form of the state, or they did not.
Yeah. So this new form must be really a completely new form.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. The French Revolution.
But if it happens just on a subjective level?
Well, you can only answer that from the point of view of your own life. So you remain faithful to this event, this romantic event, or you do not. It changes your life or it does not.
But it changes the life of the people without paper. It changes their whole life, but not of the government, for example.
Well, then it's not a political event.
Yeah. Okay, because that's why he has these categories, these four categories.
Yes, because I'm talking about love now. That's where the event operates on a subjective level. Politics operates on a universal level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So everything is divided into these four categories in his thinking?
Yes. That everything appears within one of these four categories. So the event appears within one of these four categories, within science, art, politics, or love. And it has its own forms of appearance within those four categories.
And where is philosophy? It's not among them.
Philosophy is not among them. As I said before, philosophy is the pimp of the other four. He calls it a procuress, which is a female pimp. So basically, philosophy is the one who kind of reveals the operations of the event on an intellectual level as it occurs in these other four, in the four categories.
And you started to speak about the task of philosophy, but I don't think you finished. So what's the task of philosophy?
Well, the task of philosophy is to, first of all, elaborate the ontological structure of the event, which is true in all categories, yeah? And also to explore that structure as it occurs within the different categories, and to try and elaborate, let's say, this kind of structure. But also, I think, to put forward and to present events. So, you know, let's say artists or scientists are not concerned with the kind of meta issues of what they are working on. Yeah? I mean, sometimes they are, but not necessarily. And so one of philosophy's tasks is to kind of present the ontological importance of these elements and to elaborate the structural questions related to them.
So Bagus' own philosophy or his own thinking is not the chance to becoming a new man. Because you said last time he's...
No, his own philosophy is not an event.
Well, because he was, or he is, very self-confident about what he's doing or is rank in the history of philosophy.
But it gets an event if we see it as an event.
No, it's not. The event has got nothing to do with whether we see it as an event or not. I mean, either it is or it isn't.
Yeah.
If it is, then we'll see it as an event. If it's not, we won't. It's a little bit like Kant, you know, it's like Kant with the beautiful. It's like, it's not that everyone will find it beautiful, but everyone should find it beautiful. Yeah. An event is a little bit like that. It's universal in that sense. Maybe not everybody thinks 12-tone music is an event, but everyone should think that 12-tone music is an event, in Badger's way of thinking. Yeah. I mean, it's like, not everybody knows what 12-tone music is, and even if they did know what it was, not everybody thinks that it's something that's worth thinking about, yeah? But nevertheless, from a reasonably objective point of view, 12-tone music completely changes the rules of making music. So point of view, I would argue, in relationship to something like that, it's not particularly relevant, really. It's pretty difficult to argue that 12-tone music doesn't change the nature of how to make music. Maybe you can do that, I don't know enough about it, but it seems to me that that's hard to do. It's kind of, it happened, you know what I mean? Like, it happened. It changed the way that people thought about making music. That happened. If you like it or not, it's got nothing to do with it. Okay, so he says, the next quotation, as such, art, science, and politics do change the world, not by what they discern, but by what they indiscern therein, what they make indiscernible. And the all-powerfulness of a truth is merely that of changing what is, such that this unnameable being may be, which is the very being of what is. What's the time?
40.
All right, well, I was going to carry on and talk a little bit about art, but maybe I'll leave that for next week. Talk a little bit about that, and also about the essays. And are there any questions? People seem to have a lot of questions today, so maybe we can take some questions.
I would ask you to give us a few hints how you expect us to do our essays.
I'll do that next week.
Thanks.
No, next week is scheduled. I'll talk about the essays.
Okay.
So let's leave it there. But any other questions about Badiou?
Yeah, Badiou and Guattari. Because this militancy, this word, it's Guattari kind of rejects it in Free Ecologies. He says it has nothing, this new form of living has nothing to do with militancy, and
Yes,
but now, as you said, the things about Bourdieu, I think it is a form of militancy if you really see the three ecologies as an event or as very important.
The question of the relationship of the political thinking between Deleuze, Guattari, and Bourdieu, it's interesting, and you put your finger on it. For Deleuze and Guattari particularly, because this is where the concept comes from, they talk about micro-revolution. The micro-revolution is like the opposite of the event. Yeah? The micro-revolution is the process of becoming on a political level, yeah? Which means that it always starts off on a micro-level, on a molecular level. It means there is a very small change that somehow takes a hold and is able to make a jump from kind of a small minority to a large majority. Yeah? So, in other words, for Deleuze and Guattari, it's a complete waste of time to, well, it's not a waste of time, but basically, significant political becomings are not going to occur by engaging with the dominant political ideas or regulations or rules of the time. Because when you engage with those rules or those laws, you're just confirming them. Yeah? It's a problem with representative democracy, right? Is that if you say, well, I disagree with this rule because it's unfair in relationship to this group of people, then you're just engaged in a kind of in what's known as a identity politics, which is just as kind of representative and mainstream as what it is you're resisting. But that's never going to be the way that's going to produce real transformation, because you're just going to bring in another majority in place of the old majority. And that's the deadlock of representational democracy, is that as long as it's about which majority is right, you're never going to get past this idea that it is the majority that is right. And Deleuze and Guattari say, it's never the majority that's right. What's right is the minority, the ones who are trying and experimenting and trying out new ways.
Yeah. And belonging to Bourdieu, I understand it, because he understands himself as a Maoist. And Maoist, always, if you look at China, it's, I don't know the right words, like Bienen Baben. Like these homes, and you can't take a state and put it on this land because it's so big, and it's lasting for a long time, but it will break up.
I mean, the Maoism thing is completely up for grabs. I mean, you know, there are elements of Guattari which are also obviously influenced by Maoism. You know, the idea of minor revolution is an idea that you cannot fight for large-scale political changes without making changes in yourself. Yeah? And that's also something that comes from Maoism. So this is a big issue in Marxist movements in the late 60s and the early 70s, particularly in their relationship with first-wave feminism, which is you cannot talk about equality without recognizing that within the communist movement itself, there was a great inequality in the gender relations. So you cannot go and fight for the revolution and then come home and expect your wife to have the dinner on the table for you. Yeah? So it's about, you know, that's minor politics. Minor politics is about avoiding fascism, not just on the molar level, on the level of the society in general, but inside your own head. That's what Deleuze Guattari take from Wilhelm Reich. Yeah? It's like the question of the Second World War is not how was it possible that National Socialism could do such horrible crimes. The question of the Second World War is, why did the German people want National Socialism? In other words, it's not about what they did, it's about what was going on in here. And that's what politics is about, on that level of minor politics. It's about, well, you can't make any kind of revolution unless you have some kind of mechanism by which you can sort your own shit out. Because otherwise, you're not going to be able to achieve anything. And in a way, their views, politics is similar, you know, this, except it's played out differently. So this idea of fidelity, yeah, it's about remaining faithful. It's about not giving up. It's about not being corrupted. It's about, you know, being true to the truth. Yeah.
So we can say it has to be a militant mind ecology that way?
Well, I mean, the reason why I think Guattari says there's things against militancy is particularly because he wants to separate his idea of ecology from the environmental movement,
yeah,
and from a sense of Greenpeace militants or something like that, because he says this is just some kind of ridiculous romanticism that has no relationship to what he's talking about at all. That it's not about, you know, saving Mother Earth or whatever. Yeah? It's about a environmental, subjective, and social ecology that are all intertwined. Yeah? And basically, it starts at home. So if you want to be an ecologist or an environmentalist, you can start by cleaning up your backyard. But again, we shouldn't confuse this with the idea...
We're not shooting at the backyard.
Well,
that's a problem.
I mean, you know, it's easy to say, but it's hard to imagine what it is that it means, and it should also not be confused with ideas that are becoming more and more dominant today, which in my mind are kind of defeatist concepts of, you know, like, you know, when we take an aeroplane, we pay the carbon offset, and... You know, we make sure that all our standby lights and all our home appliances are off, all our electrical bulbs are, you know, light energy efficient and so forth and so on. That's not what it means either, yeah? Because that's kind of purely reactive. That's just, well, what can I do about the problem? Well, if I do all of these things, okay, we're not saying that those are bad things to do, but we're saying that's not enough. Yeah, because there is this sense of radicality, there is this sense of radicalism. Yeah? It's about transformation. So tell me, really, what do these things transform? Well, maybe they slightly change the kind of distribution of energy or its consumption within the social body. But what does it really change? Nothing. So ecology is not a process of protection, which is this thing about militancy. Yeah, because ecological militancy tends to be organized around a rhetoric of protection. It's not a matter of protection, it's a matter of transformation. So ecology is about transforming the environment so that, you know, biodiversity has a possibility to actually present us and give us some new opportunities. Biodiversity is not about protecting biodiversity, it's about utilizing biodiversity. It's about creating biodiversity. That means new ways of doing things. It's not a protective or reactive process. It's a positive, affirmative one. Yeah? And that's what micropolitics is all about. So living ecologically means living creatively. That creates new possibilities of life. And if we create new possibilities of life, then in the end, it's also not so important whether everybody does it or not. Yeah. It's just important that they have the possibility to exist and continue to provide their own mutations and their own inventions. But that's a little bit different from bad Jews. So you create a micro ecology, a micro environment, yeah, which is able to produce biodiversity. Okay, that's a kind of micro political model. Yeah, but it's a model that's based on becoming. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to create the conditions under which something can mutate into something else. That's freedom, in Guattari's terms, political freedom. Yeah? Bourdieu's terms are something different, right? Bourdieu's terms is about you have the truth, it emerges in a movement, and militancy is to remain faithful to that event, to force it into truth. Yeah? You see, Bourdieu's it's a much more kind of muscular. This is what I was talking about last week, something patriarchal about it. Yeah? It's very confrontational. It's It's very polemical. It's very, you know, as you say in German, comfort. It's like it really wants to, it wants to fight. It's whereas the Deleuze-Guattari thing, it's much more kind of baroque, you know. It's much more underground, you know. You can do it on your own, maybe. That's a, like a microclimate. You know, I mean, they do say, I mean, in the end, you can create a little microclimate, and then, like, who cares, you know. But it has to grow. You know, but it's much more, there is no single truth. It's a process of experimentation. That's what politics is for Guattari. It's what micropolitics is. Yeah? It's not determined about, is it true, is it not true? Did I force it into the situation? Didn't I force it into the situation? You know, it's not, doesn't have those sorts of ultimate universal criteria. The criteria, well, what happened? Is it still alive? You know, what kind of life was it? You know, was it a free life? Did desire proliferate? Yeah? What were the blockages? What were the the kind of internal fascisms of this life? Yeah? How can we free ourselves from those and so forth and so on? So it's a very different model for activism and for militancy. Alright, we can talk about it more maybe next week. I'll see you. Ich bin jetzt der Mann. Du tust nicht stolen.